Hey, football fans, this is Diana Rossini from The Athletic. Get the top stories in pro football snapped directly to your inbox with our latest NFL newsletter, Scoop City. Jacob Robinson and I will bring you the daily scoop of top NFL articles, posts, and podcasts every Monday to Friday. Sign up for free now at theathletic.com/scoop.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Standing Room Only podcast. Yes, I'm your host, Ben Standing. I cover the Washington Commanders for The Athletic. It is Friday here in the DMV. Hope everyone is heading into the weekend with much positivity in their world. Not even sure why I just said that, but, you know, be happy. Why not? The draft is less than 2 weeks away. That's one reason to be happy. We'll soon find out what the Washington Commanders plan to do with the number 2 overall pick. If you missed it, the last episode, ESPN's Adam Schefter joined me to discuss what he thinks could be in play for the Commanders at 2, whether it's Jaden Daniels, Drake May. We talked about J.J. McCarthy. We talked about the flow of information, the noise, all the not-so-fun aspects of the conversation that we're all trying to have throughout free agency and the draft. It was a really interesting conversation, I would say, and I really appreciate the feedback from so many of you. I've got two more conversations to go today regarding the draft and the Commanders. One, my guy Matt Barrows, who covers the 49ers for The Athletic, he has been on this podcast before. He joined me to give us an insight into Adam Peters and what we might be looking at from an Adam Peters draft. Matt, obviously, as I said, has covered the 49ers, and it's hard to know what an assistant GM will do, because you never know for sure where does the main GM, in that case, John Lynch, where does the head coach, in this case, Kyle Shanahan, where do they stop and where does the assistant GM begin? Except in this instance, Peters was known as the draft guy. So we get Matt's insight into what could be in play for Washington, not so much just at quarterback, but in other positions as well. And then lastly, our guy Al Galdi hopped on with me yesterday, right around the time that we heard that O.J. Simpson had died from cancer. So as Al's not as old as me, but as two guys who are around for all that, we discussed the O.J. Impact, that trial, what it meant to ultimately to society, the media, and so on. And of course, we also got into kind of just where things are at with the Commanders right now with the number 2 pick and beyond. So a really jam-packed episode. I'm excited for you to hear it. And we'll do that in a moment on the Standing Room Only podcast, which of course you can find on iTunes, Spotify, or anywhere you do your podcasting. Al and I talked about several topics, including my new poll that is up on The Athletic, went up on Thursday, where I talked to roughly 17 sources around the league for their view of this quarterback class. Seventeen kindly gave their rankings, top 4 picks among these quarterbacks, as well as some were willing to share their specific commentary on what they like, or in some cases are not fans of, with these prospects, how they see some of this all shaking out. I did talk to a couple of other sources who just didn't want to do the rankings, but were willing to chat. So that's why I said roughly 17. So again, another one where the feedback has been fantastic. You guys are great. I think it's something that resonates for people who are any of the teams that are focused on quarterbacks. It wasn't specifically about Washington per se, but because the draft essentially now starts at 2 with Caleb Williams going 1, everything with the quarterbacks is really kind of about the Commanders, because they will be setting the pace for everybody else. So we did get into that as well. Beyond that, you know, we're definitely in a bit of a lull period here right now. The pro days are done. 30 visits are happening. Expect next week to hear about more than just quarterbacks coming in town. I think we're going to hear quite a few names that will be here next week. Some of them are already out there. Some we'll see. But that is always, you know, an interesting aspect to all this. And I do think for me, you know, just learning how this group is handling their business. What does even a top 30 visit mean? Is it just dinner at DC Prime over there in Ashburn, where the team tends to frequent a lot when they have events like this, and then come back the next day at the facility and go through the game tape or other ways to learn about the person and the player? Do they have their own different ideas? I'm curious to see what they do, how they handle it. This is all, I mean, of course, we're focused on the draft and the number two pick, but this is all part of the puzzle to figure out what is going to be different here moving forward with regards to just how they function and how they think and how they, I don't want to say treat as if it was like a bad treatment before, but just how they go about their business here. It's a reflection of the process, but also of the organization and the takeaways that others get. And, you know, draft picks today are free agents in 4 years. And you want to make, you know, it's important to make a good impression, because you never know down the line who will somebody that you might want to bring into your building, and you want them to be receptive to that. And this is often going to be the first impression that people have, whether it's the 30 visit or just meeting the organization some point along the way. All right, that's it here from me for the intro. Let's start with Al Galdi. We spoke yesterday afternoon about where we are with the Commanders at 2 and reflection on the O.J. Simpson trial and what that has meant for media and society going forward. We'll talk about it for a few minutes, but then we get a lot into the Commanders. And then my guy, Matt Barrows, our 49ers insider, with a guide to Adam Peters and the NFL draft here on the Standard Room Only podcast. All right. You know, got to get life back on track here for this podcast, which means got to get Al Galdi back on the show. And Al, look, there's a lot of things I would normally think I could discuss with you. You know, we could discuss, of course, what are the Commanders going to do at number two? Maybe other things about the Commanders draft. You're a guy that knows a lot about baseball. Jackson Holliday makes his major league debut yesterday. We could get into that. There's only one topic right this second as we're talking at 12:26 on Thursday. O.J. Simpson died, passed away because of cancer, which I didn't even know that he had. It is one of those rare topics that everybody, at least of a certain age, it is, they remember that period of time when the trial was going on and everything, and the car chase. This year's the 30th anniversary. That was the only topic any of us were discussing. It's like the entire country was discussing who the Commanders are going to pick at two. But, like, not just, like, people. Like, every television cable show. Like, literally, this started the modern era of media, I would say.
Yeah, and I'd say the O.J. trial was only slightly less divisive than the Commanders quarterback conversation is. But it's incredible, and it was like the ultimate intersection, right, of sports and, like, real actual news. And not just because O.J. was a famous running back, but because of the Bronco chase happening during Knicks Rockets on a Friday night in the NBA Finals. And, you know, if you are of a certain age, and you don't have to be that old, but you remember the chase and you remember the trial, and it's impossible to forget those things. And you're right. I think in a lot of ways it did usher in the new media age. It, I think, forever changed how we look at athletes from a standpoint of we make these guys, we don't. And you always have to sort of be careful with that when you're like, you know, you heap lavish praise on someone. Oh, he's such a great guy. He might be. And most of these guys are good people. It's not like they're all bad guys. But you don't know. You don't know what's happening behind the scenes. You don't know what's going down. And this was a really instructive thing, to say nothing of course, the trial, the race implications, what it said about if you have money, how you can get out of basically anything. There's so much to it. So, yeah. And the other funny thing, too, is that social media is now. Can you imagine No. Twitter slash in 1994, 1995, when all the OJ stuff was happening. Like, I can't imagine what that would have been like, because that was all consuming, that entire situation.
Right. You can't say Twitter slash other things, because in the case of OJ, slash takes on a whole different meaning.
Jeez.
Sorry, it's terrible. Yeah, no, it was like, okay, it's one thing to say, do you remember where you were when the chase happened? I remember where I was. I was driving to, I guess it was Memorial weekend, right, when the whole thing happened, basically. And I was driving to Ocean City. It was the first time I was driving, not that Ocean City is like driving across the country, but it was the first time I was driving by myself for that much, for that distance, you know? And because everybody else is already there. And I get in my car, I'm like on 495 heading towards the beach, when it said that we already knew that she had been killed, but we don't know exactly what's going on, or it been said that a warrant had been issued. And it was that night that the chase happened. So I remember where I was, because the whole way down there, it's not like I had Sirius XM or anything. Like, I drove the whole way down finding any radio station I could updating on what the hell was happening. It was, it was crazy. I mean, yeah, OJ Simpson, I mean, I'm sure, again, if you're of a certain age, all you know is this trial. But he was, boy, I don't even know what the modern athlete would be. I mean, it was like he was, you know, I mean, as famous as LeBron is, maybe, I don't want to say more so, because LeBron's pretty damn famous, but like we didn't have as much stuff. So anybody who was famous back then was exponentially even more famous, because, and he was doing, you know, commercials for Hertz. He was in Monday Night Football. He's in the Naked Gun movies. Like, you know, it's just, yeah. And to your point about, we don't know. I always preface that when somebody says to me, what's so-and-so like? I'm like, as far as I know, he seems pretty good. Like, you know, I don't know, but as far as I can tell, he seems pretty good. It was a, you remember where you were when the verdict came down?
I was in high school. I was in Latin class at Georgetown Prep High School, and we didn't have class that day, and we watched the verdict, and it was unbelievable because it felt like, you know, if you had a brain, you knew he was guilty. Okay. But we know that there was a lot that went into that jury, and there was an excellent multi-part documentary on ESPN. I want to say like 6, 7, 8 years ago.
Yeah,
might have been like a lengthy 30 for 30. And it was awesome. And it really did a great job of explaining what happened here, why what happened. Had some never before seen slash heard footage of OJ being abusive to Nicole. I mean, it was really jaw-dropping, some of the stuff that was in this documentary. But yeah, that freaking trial was unreal. I remember too, so during the trial, on what was then Sports Radio 570 in D.C., Imus in the Morning was the morning show.
Oh, boy.
And so I used to listen to Imus, because I used to listen to that station all the time. And, like, all Imus talked about was this trial. And so, it really was this, like, all-consuming daily soap opera. And, of course, we came to know all the lawyers. We came to know the judge, Judge Lance Ito. I mean, here we are years later. And, again, if you were around, remember the names, you remember, you know, if it don't fit, you must have quit, like all that stuff. And then, like, the branching off from that trial, right? So, like, Kardashian was one of the lawyers, and now the Kardashians have become, you know, these, like, iconic forces in pop culture in this country. There was that FX series a few years back that went through the OJ trial with David Schwimmer playing Robert Kardashian, right? It's like all this stuff that has come from that entire saga. It's unreal. And, well, and of course, you know, there's the bottom line of two. No, I was gonna say, there's the bottom line of, oh, by the way, two people died, you know, like two. But yeah, it really is something.
Yeah. And also, like, other things, putting aside the OJ Simpson part itself, I think for me, it was the first time that I had ever heard that they had this new technique that had been developed to, a new process developed to help identify, you know, the guilty in these situations. It was called DNA. Like, I don't remember DNA ever being used in such a way where, like, or maybe we knew it, but, like, you know, it was being used in somewhat real time to figure out what the heck, you know, what had happened here. But prior to that, it was not. And then it became such a staple for everything, of course, in like pop culture, and beyond. Also, like, she doesn't host a show anymore on any of the cable network. Well, maybe she does, I don't know. But like Greta Van Susteren, she became like the first like legal analyst, I recall. Like, she was on television the way like we picture like Steve Kornacki on election night. That's how she was every day, basically. We talk about binge watching shows today. That's what everybody did. They went to work, they came home, and then they turned on CNN or whatever to watch the OJ trial. Either like, here, we're going to replay today's session of 3 hours of could be nothing, but we're watching the whole time. It was incredible. Just from a population standpoint, as you said, people died. It's sad. By the way, one last thing, and then we'll move off of this. You said that the things that stick in our head, that Lance Ito, Cato Kalen. I was just out in L.A., ahead of this, when the Commanders played the Rams, I took my bye week, went out there, rented a car, I'm driving around, and I've been to LA a few times, so this isn't like I'm doing this on purpose, but I was driving around, and I would purposely take like the long way sometimes to get to where I was going, because I wanted to drive around, and I'm driving, and I see a sign that said, I was getting off on the highway exit, and it said like Bundy, or is it Drive, Road, whatever, and I was like, oh. And I was like, hold on, I've been here, I went here before. I figured out, I knew how to get to, basically, like, I knew it was Bundy and what, oh crap, I'm blank. I knew enough to know how to find the house that unfortunately Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were killed at. And like, I wouldn't even know half the streets around here, anything, but I was like, Bundy in LA. I'm like, am I near this? And like, yep, sure enough, I drove up to it and there it was. So, and we didn't even mention, of course, that, you know, he was, you know, one of the best football players of all time. First one to ever get 2,000 yards in a 14-game season. I can't remember if he was the first one that started, like, USC into tailback U, but, you know, one of the greatest college football players ever. It's crazy. By the way, I didn't even know that he – did you know he had cancer?
No, I think this is one property never announced that he was ill, and then like you find out when he dies, basically, that he was dealing with something. So you know, now a lot of times there is a perceived nobility in doing things that way. Like I remember when the lead singer of Queen, Freddie Mercury, died.
Mm-hmm.
I think he announced like a day or two before he died that he had AIDS, and then he died like a few days later. And so yeah, like sometimes we'll see that. But I, you know, with OJ, there ain't no nobility, man. You know, I don't like celebrating anyone's death, but yeah. I don't know. I don't know how you talk about OJ and you mourn this, or you don't, you know, focus on what he pretty clearly did, but got acquitted for. I mean, you mentioned the DNA thing. It's basically 100% that he did it, if you go by the DNA evidence. Okay. Which we know is like bulletproof. It's foolproof. Now it was a new form of evidence at the time.
Right.
There was this very ugly racery in that part of the country. And so you had a jury that I think in a lot of ways OJ to be innocent, or wanted sort of this as a jury, because so many times there had been black people who had been wrongfully convicted of things. So there was a lot that went into all of this, but like, if you just follow the science, if you just follow the data, like, he did it, man. Okay. And like, I don't know how you escape that. So he got away with murder. He did. And it's incredible, but it happened.
Right. And that's the thing. That's how early DNA was. Like, if I said to you right now, somebody the equivalent or anybody, they go to court, the prosecution says, okay, we have the DNA evidence that says this person did it. You'd be like, well, okay. Unless there's some really weird stuff. But back then it was so new. Yeah. It was not viewed as this is slam dunk. It was like, oh, you have some fancy thing here. And like you said, because of the relationships, the poor relationship in LA between cops and minorities, black people, that it was, everything you were saying was distrustful. It wasn't viewed as this is a pretty much of a lock situation.
Yeah, and there was the Mark Furman thing with his racial history, and so there was a thought that, like, he sprinkled OJ's DNA around. So, you know, there was that aspect of it. There's, you know, I'm no legal expert. People to this day who know this stuff, prosecution did a terrible job and that the defense team put aside the morality here. The defense team did a really good job. So there was so much that went into all of this and why he got acquitted.
It's crazy stuff. Well, anyway, I'm sure cable TV will be full of a lot of look backs. And you're right, the ESPN documentary was tremendous. I definitely, it basically is just like an 8-part 30 for 30. If you haven't seen it, it's really well done. And even the TV miniseries with, you mentioned Schwimmer, John Travolta's in it. It was worth your time. Even if it's just to
That's
see.
That's right, Travolta.
He plays Robert Shapiro, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right. You can tell on some level that we're, at least I am, a little bit getting tired of talking about the Commanders picking it too, even though I just wrote a story about all the quarterbacks that we'll discuss here in a second. But, you know, I was going to ask you, you know, I do listen to you and I listen to Sheehan and, you know, other podcasts, other radio shows. I don't listen to everything that everybody does, but it feels like whenever I turn on anybody, all anybody is talking about is the quarterback situation, unless there was like something that happened that day, even if it's a minor signing of whatever. What is everybody talking about besides the quarterback? Or what are you talking about besides the quarterback? Like what is there? What is being discussed?
With the Commanders, not much. I mean, when Terry McLaurin did his media avail with you guys last week, I took a break from the quarterback stuff and, you know, talked about what Terry had to say. But I almost felt guilty for doing that because, yeah, like, this is what matters. This is massive. This decision that this team is about to make, I don't think we can overstate this. I mean, when you came on my podcast last week, I brought up the idea that I think this is the most important draft in the history of the franchise. And I don't think that that's overstating this. So, you know, are there other things you could talk about? Sure. But like, does it really matter right now whether Nick Allegretti is going to be the starting left guard? Like, you know, we'll have time to get into that stuff in a few months. Okay. Like, this quarterback decision is this team has got to get this right. And, you know, you can zoom out of that a little bit of the top 100 picks. Like, there's an opportunity over the first two nights of this draft to have one of these, you know, Bobby Bethard-like transformational franchise-altering draft. So there's that aspect of it, too. It's funny. Thursday night is a huge deal. Friday night could be even more insane because Thursday night they'll make the pick at two, and then there's at least a decent chance they're done. Now, they could trade back into the first round. But Friday night, with the five picks, 2 second-rounders and 3 third-rounders, I mean, I feel like people leaping on this. I know that you're not, but that Friday night, that night two of the draft could be bonkers for all of us as Commanders fans and observers.
Well, at my place, at least in the recent years, they have been wanting us to write profiles on basically the first round pick, obviously, and then like any day two pick. And then on day three, if it's a quarterback or somebody of note. And I'm thinking to myself on that Friday, oh, my Lord, I'm going to be. I really hope they trade like four picks to move up to 15 or something in the draft. I mean, that's way too much happening there. So yeah. You're right though. Cause like I was prepping for this and I was thinking, okay, you know, what should Al and I talk about? I was coming up with some bit like, all right, here's a bunch of different topics. Let's imagine we're on Survivor. Let's vote them out one by one till we get to the one that's most important. And I was like, yeah, what's the point? And everything else is, I'd have to take quarterback just completely out because otherwise what does it matter? And I know that, like, of course you're right. You know, it is the most important thing. It's not the only thing, but you know, in terms of, it is hard to get ginned up, even like left tackle. Sure. Yes. They need one. I totally get it. But like, all right, they got Cornelius Lucas. I mean, you know, the world doesn't end if they don't somehow figure this out. Whereas like, you know, the quarterback discussion, no matter what they do, it's going to be incredibly polarizing, I imagine. For you, now that we are here, now that you've done nothing but talk about this, you've talked to a bunch of guests, you know, you consume the media as much as anybody. Do you feel like you are any closer to figuring out what's going to happen than you were when the season ended, basically, or at least a few months ago?
Well, my preference has been that the team takes Drake May. And I don't say that because I despise Jaden Daniels and J.J. McCarthy. I think there are a lot of things to like with all of these guys. I get a kick out of the people who try to frame it as, no, it has to be this guy because the other two are, you know, or the other two are so far below this guy who I won. Like, close. I think it's okay to say that it's close. And I think all of the conflicting opinions are reflect that it is close. It's not an easy call. So my preference, though, in terms of what I think they're going to do, well, look, it's impossible to deny that there does seem to be a momentum for Jaden Daniels. Now, you know, is the momentum real, or is it going to turn out that the momentum was not so real? And, you know, people were off on this. But, I mean, I go by, look, you've been mocking Jaden to the Commanders. Mel Kiper Jr. has been mocking Jaden to the Commanders. Adam Schefter now on each of his last two podcasts has said that the signs are indicating the Commanders will take Daniels. Colin Cowherd on his show this past Monday afternoon said that he was told that at least as of that day, Monday, the Commanders would take Jaden Daniels. So, you know, you're ignoring what's around us if you don't at least acknowledge that, hey, there does seem to be a lot out there indicating that Washington's going to take Daniels. But again, we know how this has been, and you and I have talked about this. The Commanders are playing things very close to the vest. A lot of the reading of the tea leaves is just that. It's not necessarily coming from the organization, but people around the organization. Doesn't mean those people are wrong. Doesn't mean that this momentum is wrong. But I think that that's an important aspect of all this, that unless something's happening here that we don't know, the team is not leaking any of this. And so people are just kind of going off intuition and what people outside the organization say. So, you know, right now, if you had to make a bet, I think you probably would say Daniels. The betting market certainly is reflective of that. But I do have concerns with him. So that's one of the reasons why, personally, I'm leaning May.
Well, you know, as somebody who is, you know, it was one thing when we were doing the coaching search and I, you know, everybody's talking about Ben Johnson. And I'm like, okay, I get it. I guess I'm just not hearing anything. I'm still trying to figure out this new group. Do I not know how to like get in touch with anybody involving anything of that's involved? Like, but then I realized like other people are sort of not reporting anything specific either. It's all these vague notions. And then the game of telephone and the way that, you know, media and social media works, we have to talk about something. So all anybody was hearing was Ben Johnson. And you're like, well, okay, that's when it became like, well, wait a minute. I'm not actually hearing he's getting it. I'm just only hearing people repeating the same information. I'm starting to feel like we're getting to the same point here. As somebody who, as you know, I've pointed out and you just did, like, I have had Jaden Daniels in my mock at number two in various mocks for the last month. You mentioned other people who have said the same thing. I had Schefter on my podcast yesterday randomly, and we discussed this, including what he said on his podcast about quote unquote signs. And he basically admitted too, like, I don't know. Like, I mean, I'm just looking at what information is there, and based on the information, I'm saying that, but it's clear, you know, and it's just like the rest of us that we don't know. Every time somebody does a mock draft and they say Jaden Daniels or whoever they pick for Washington at two, it somewhere says, there's not a lot of information. I really don't know. So for all we know, Adam Peters could be all in on J.J. McCarthy, right? Everybody thinks that J.J. McCarthy is a guy that like a Kyle Shanahan offense would really like. And while Cliff Kingsbury is not running that offense, Peters was there for the last, you know, 7 years. Dan Quinn had Shanahan as his OC in Atlanta. J.J. McCarthy, it's an odd bit. Like, I think people say, like, he doesn't have the same high ceiling that maybe some of the other guys do, but some of what he does, particularly ability to throw on time, read the defense, you know, willingness to throw over the middle, that he does it at a really high level. And whatever is to be said for winning, he obviously did that. 27-1 as a starting quarterback the last 2 years in Michigan with a national title. But, you know, I could tell you the same thing about Drake May, that he's got the prototype size, that, you know, his upside is bigger than even Jaden Daniels. I think there's compelling arguments to make for all of them. There's compelling issues with all of them. And I sort of hate to admit this, but as somebody who's sitting here trying to figure this out, I don't feel that much more confident in anything I thought than I thought a month ago about any of this. My only thing is just talking to more people, as I just did in this story, but it's not like I'm getting like, it's not like there's like major consensus. Daniels was picked as essentially consensus was the second highest quarterback behind Caleb Williams and a little bit ahead, a decent amount ahead of May and McCarthy. But I wouldn't, again, having talked to these people, shit, knowing what I heard them say, even beyond what I put out there, I still don't know.
I don't think anybody does. I mean, you know, I read your piece, and you can come away from that piece saying, all right, Jaden Daniels should be the pick and will be the pick. You can come away from that piece saying, all right, Drake May should be the pick and will be the pick. Like, that's how it is. It's hard to remember something like this. Now, obviously, there are years in which there is debate about, like, who the QB1 is, should take at quarterback. But this does seem to be a legitimate three-way battle. Like, there are really compelling arguments for all three of these guys. The only thing that really seems to be a consensus opinion is that Caleb Williams is the QB1 in this draft. Although I've even spoken to people on my podcast who combat that. But generally speaking, I think people have Caleb as the QB1. But yeah, Beyond that, there is so much variance. And, you know, I've thought about, okay, well, are there themes here? Like, at times it has seemed to me that the analytics community likes May the most, but like the more traditional scouting community likes Jaden Daniels the most. So I don't know. That's a theme that I think there's some truth to. But even with that, you know, you will find people who don't necessarily fall right into what I just out there. So it's one of the trickier calls we've had. I think the frightening thing, I know for me as a Commanders fan, is, you know, that these guys aren't going to all hit. And so, like, this is like, you know, you have to choose between three doors, right? And if you open up one door, there's a pot of gold. But if you open up the other door, you're going to get hit over the head with a shovel. And then if you open up the door after that, you know, you're going to fall off the top of a cliff. So it's like, which is the right door to choose? Because there is a decent chance that only one of these three guys ends up being good. Maybe two, but it's almost certainly not going to be all three. And so I think that's a big part of this game too. And that's how I've tried to approach this is, okay, we can talk about each guy's strengths and what he does well and how it'll translate, but who's most likely to bust? Assuming that at least one busts, who is that guy? And even with that, there's a lot of differing opinion. Like, you know, I think you could look at Jaden Daniels and see the injury risk and the pressure to sack rate item and say, okay, you know, there's a real bust potential there. You look at Drake May. Even his biggest supporters say there's work that needs to be done, and it may take, you know, a season or two for him to be what he can. Well, there's bust potential right there. J.J. McCarthy, he's so young. He didn't throw that many passes at Michigan, relatively speaking. So there's an unknown. Like, you're really projecting if you take him and buy in on him. So, yeah, good luck. I mean, this is a tough call for Adam. He's not like 2012. It was clearly Andrew Luck, QB1, RG3, QB2. Forget about how that quarterback class wound up with a third-round pick and a fourth-round pick as maybe the two best quarterbacks in that. Going into that draft, it was as clear as can be. There was zero debate. QB1, QB2, Robert. It's not like that this time. A lot out there that is conflicting.
And even back to 2019, like, the public debate, most people seem to have Dwayne Haskins over Daniel Jones. Daniel Jones had this late rise to push him up to where he ended up going. But for here, I think we all were like, it's going to be Dwayne Haskins because of the owner, if nothing else. Sure. So, like, even saying, even for that, the wasn't, I think Dwayne Haskins was a pretty clear option. Yeah, I will just say, right? Versus now, it's like we're saying, I don't know. I am largely been dismissing the Penix and Bo Nix aspect as if, like, to say they make the trade down, get that whole haul of picks or whatever we're imagining they would get, and then instead of trading back up, still take one of those guys. Maybe, again, I don't know, but I'm not buying that one. They're both a little bit, you know, on the older side relative. I mean, not that 24 is ancient, but, you know, a little bit older. The ceiling may be a little bit lower, particularly for Penix because of the injury. So I'm kind of dismissing those two. And obviously, we're assuming Caleb is going one. So that leaves three. But, yes, I could talk myself into any of these directions. Before I let you go, you mentioned that you'd read the story that I put up. So if we were going to flip this and I was on your show and based on having read that, you wanted to ask questions, I was going to turn it over to you for a couple seconds. So based on that, is there anything that you had a takeaway from or anything you wanted to ask me about?
Yeah. So I think, you know, if you're really trying to narrow this down, it does feel like Daniels versus May. I think you have to have McCarthy as part of the conversation. question, but if there's anything that does seem prevailing with this specific to the Commanders, it's that out of the three guys, Daniels and May seem to be the two who are most likely to be taken by Washington at two. And you'll notice all the qualifiers I'm putting into this because we don't know. Like, I think, you know, you can't like 100%. But that said, do you think that the opinion from the people you talk to is that Jaden Daniels has the higher floor and Drake May has the higher ceiling? Can we at least say that? Or do you think that we can't even say that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is now me more inferring or interpreting what they said, because I don't know if I necessarily asked that question to everybody or we even got into that. But I do feel like that is sort of the deal. Like I think the one comment, even the people who are really high on Drake May all kind of say he can't play next year. Like that should not be what anybody is looking to do. And, you know, others said, yep, of the six, five of them could start week one if they had to, including McCarthy, who's the youngest. Not Drake May. So you're basically automatically saying Drake May is a future upside play, whereas Jaden Daniels, you know, not only was he the one that was consistently mentioned as, like, three of the 17 voters picked Jaden Daniels over Williams just flat out. And others said it's pretty close. He would be, like, number one. Like Chris Sims had said he'd be number one in another year and that type of stuff. But it does feel like, you know, also the experience. Daniels, like, 53 starts. Drake May and McCarthy both in the 20s. So yeah, I do think it's more like that, which isn't to say that Daniels doesn't have potential. Obviously he does, but yes, it is more, Daniels is more immediate. May is you're taking that shot. And if he was to come here, I would think it, assuming that they have, the team has the same opinion of pretty much everybody else, we're seeing a lot of Marcus Mariota next year.
Oh, God. That does not excite me. That does not excite many people listening. I can promise you that. All right, another question. So regarding the biggest concerns with each guy. So with May, it's some version of he has a lot of easy misses / he has bad footwork. You know, those are like things that come up with him. Daniels, there is the injury worry about him being reckless as a runner in conjunction with the thin frame. There's also that pressure to sack rate item. Of the principal concerns with each guy, which concern has struck you as the biggest from the people you've spoken with? Like, is there one concern about one of those guys that has stood out above the others when you've talked about those guys with people?
Yeah. Great question. Like where your head's at. I'm flipping through some of these quotes here just to see if anything comes to mind. I mean, it's kind of like everything you just said is the issue. And I think the biggest concern is kind of what I was just saying, that like you're really having to project a lot as to what you think Drake May is going to become, because it's going to take a while. I had a quote here from an active assistant coach who said, May is Herbert light. Take everything Herbert does and make it less. They'll be compared, parentheses, because of their prototype size, but there's no comparison. I like May, but when I see the amount of work it will take to have him reach his potential, we'll be fired first. I feel like that's the thing. It's like, you know, when we talk about like a player needs a year to rest, sometimes that's just an experience thing, but sometimes it's because they have a lot of work to do. And I feel like here, and that's the case with May, and when you're saying that, to me, that isn't just wait a year and should be good. It's wait a year and then we'll see. Like, I think that there's a lot of uncertainty that goes with the idea of having him sit. Now, again, some of the throws he makes are, you know, jaw-dropping. Some of the, you know, he's got that size. He can move, you know, pretty well. So it's not like anybody's going, well, this is, there's nothing to work with. It's just, it's almost, you know, when you do these types of things, and even though these people have their own opinions, they all hear the same rumor mills, even more so than we do, perhaps. So you have to wonder at some point, where does groupthink come in? I will tell you, like, these people, it wasn't like I got like eight people from the same organization. And I know there's constant, anybody who says something negative about one of these guys, like, oh, must be one of those teams that wants a quarterback and they're trying to move him down. I will promise you that, I mean, unless there's like some secret thing I don't know about, that was not happening. That wasn't the case here. So that seems to be, you know, if that's a reality that he is just that far away, I think that's probably ultimately the biggest concern, because whether it's the mechanics, the decision making, I almost think I'm rambling here. I almost think it's like, for what they're now seeing on tape at North Carolina, the regression that they saw, again, he lost his offensive coordinator. He had several people leave the offense, similar to when Sam Howell's last year. And it's almost like they want to see, okay, what happened? Was he a victim of circumstances, or did he really go backwards? And I guess it sounds like people aren't convinced enough one way or the other, but maybe having him in your building for a year helps solve that mystery, as well as helps improve him. But that's still a risk you're taking, having to use a high pick like that for somebody that a lot of people don't seem to know when he's going to be ready to go.
And of course, the wild part with all of this is how these guys are as people. And that's a big part of the mystery here. We don't know. The teams only know so much. And, you know, that's a big part of the pre-draft process, as we know. But, you know, what also makes this trickier is that everything I've heard and read about all three of these guys, May, Daniels, McCarthy, is that they're good guys. You know, there hasn't been anything that has come up of, well, this guy's got kind of an ego. You know, even with Robert in 2012, there was that report, I believe it was from Nolan Narwaki, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
But there was a report that came out about Robert that we all kind of ignored, didn't want to believe, and it turned out to be prophetic. There's been nothing like that with Daniels and May and McCarthy. In fact, it's been the opposite. I mean, people rave about these guys. And, you know, when you hear talk, they come off really well. They come off mature and smart. And so even that is close, where it's not like one guy's a jerk or two of are bad teammates, so you know you can lean more in one direction. It's like, no, they all seem to be good people. So, or at least off our conversation earlier, they all seem to be good people, and so that's of course part of the evaluation process.
I know you consume everything. Have you gone back and watched like any of their interviews, or maybe even like during, you know, whatever, even now, like they're at the combine or they're talking to some reporter. Have you done that? Because I have a reason why I'm asking that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think Drake May looks and acts the part as well as anyone basically can. So now I don't know what that means. I mean, maybe he's a big phony, you know, and he just acts it really well. But watching his interviews and watching how he handled himself, he comes off very mature, you know, self-aware, all these things that you want from a quarterback, from a leader. So I think that is what has stood out to me as much as anything. I think May really stands out. And that was the reporting during the combine. As you know, it was that May was killing it in these interview teams. And I could see why and how.
Yeah. And I would say that, like, I heard early on that, like, because even like some of Jaden Daniels' teammates, when I was at the Senior Bowl, said, you know, he's kind of a quieter guy. Like, he's more of a lead by example, which is completely reasonable. But that position, that is a position where some people prefer a pure alpha. Like, you've got to be, it can't just be you're doing your thing and people, you're hoping people follow you. You need to really get, you know, have that personality. And I almost wonder if one of the reasons why Sam Howell, one of the questions for him is that, like, he's got to do more, he's got to be more of a vocal leader, I guess. I will also say, though, that, like, purely just watching the TV, just like everybody else, every time I see JJ McCarthy, I'm like, yeah, kind of like that guy. Like, he, there's, if I'm not saying that, like you said, they're all seem like reasonable people. There's a certain authenticity with him that stands out more. I saw one the other day. He's been pretty open about meditating. He goes like out on the field before games and meditates. He's talked about that. He said after he meditates, he typically goes and listens to Bob Marley all day long. That sounds like the kind of thing that somebody could potentially just does it make up to sound quirky or whatever, but with him, I kind of buy it. And I don't know. And, you know, QB wins are, you know, wins are not a QB stat, whatever. 27-1, pretty good. I don't know. So this is my issue. This is encapsulating my issue. I'm in on Jaden Daniels. I think that's the guy. Boy, Drake May though, man, you look at all the size. He looks like every Super Bowl winner from like all the way up until like the last 10 years or so. And Drake May, I mean, J.J. McCarthy, you know, boy, I kind of like what he does too. So, this is my head every day, all over the place. And I wish somebody would tell me what to do already at this point. I mean, I'm half kidding, but not really.
Yeah, you almost wish the quarterback class wasn't this good because it would be easier. But of course, that wouldn't guarantee anything anymore. I mean, you know, you go back to the last time Washington had an upper two overall pick, 2020. One of the reasons, and there were multiple, but one of the reasons that the Chase Young pick was seen as like a fait accompli was that that quarterback class after Burrow was not seen as great. It was seen as sort of, well, it could be good, but we're not really sure. There were major injury worries about Tua Tagovailoa. People were poking all kinds of holes in Justin Herbert. And lo and behold, you look at that 2020 quarterback class now, just look at the first two rounds. Burrow, Tua, Herbert, Jordan Love, Jalen Hurts. I mean, that is an awesome quarterback class right now, and yet it wasn't perceived that way going into that draft. So we have no idea what this class will end up being. This could be a great class. On paper, it looks like a good class, but, you know, we just don't know. I'd say this, too, about McCarthy. His youth, I think, is something that really is appealing. That, you know, obviously quarterbacks can play well deep into their 30s, if not 40s. But because he's so young, he just turned 21 in January. You see, like, you say to yourself, okay, if he's like this now already, if he's this mature already, if he has been this successful as a quarterback already, he's where Jaden Daniels was 2 years ago. You know, so like, where might McCarthy be 2 years from now? And I think that's a big part of the appeal with him. Now, Drake May's 21, too, but I think he's like 6 months older than McCarthy. But McCarthy, you're really getting someone who's young, who has potential to grow. And if he's already at this point, where might he be in a year or two?
All right. Well, where we're going to be next week, assuming Al lets me back, is on his podcast, the Al Galdi podcast. But for now, I'm going to let Al go back to his life. He was kind enough to jump on here with me at the relatively last second. And I don't know if we got anywhere today, Al, but it was good venting. It was good therapy to talk to a fellow traveler who is like, well, one of these days we'll talk about something else besides who's going to be at two. But for now, that is what matters. Al, you rock. I appreciate it.
Well, you ever need to be. And anytime, if you ever need to be taken to Mexico, I've got a Ford Bronco. You can jump in the back, grab your passport, and I'll take you down. And nothing or no one will stop us. I can promise you that.
I believe it, man. I appreciate it. All right, Al. We'll talk later. See you, man.
Sounds good.
All right. As promised, joining the podcast, he's coming back, our returning champion, Matt Barrows, who covers the 49ers for The Athletic. We've had a busy offseason here. With everything new, you've had a busy offseason, I imagine, just simply catching your breath after a Super Bowl run and, you know, seeing what this new regime is going to do next. How's it been going?
It's been going well, yeah. Finally, we're having an interesting April here. The 49ers had traded away most of their top picks the last 2 years for Trey Lance, and that did not work out great. And I'm sure you might be asking me some questions about that later on. But point being that Aprils have been boring here the last 2 years. And, you know, they picked 31st. So it's not rip-roaring here this year, but it's a little bit better than it was the last couple of years.
Well, it's always interesting, right? When you know, in my case, how do they do a rebuild? In your case, how do they stay at the top? How do they, you know, get over the top, I guess you could say, and winning it. So everybody's got their own interesting tidbits. And of course, they also had to figure out, I guess, how to replace Adam Peters, which is, of course, partly why we're talking beyond the fact that I enjoy talking to Matt, who's a DMVer himself. How did they replace Peters? I'm not even sure, actually.
They basically promoted two other guys to bigger positions inside the room. A guy named Tariq Ahmad is basically going to be the new Adam, where he'll probably run the draft the way that Adam did. And I think that's important to bring up that John Lynch was the GM, but John Lynch came in without any front office experience whatsoever. And it came in right before a very big draft in 2017. And it was basically Adam Peters who ran that draft and who's been running all the other drafts since then. So this is Adam Peters' bailiwick. This is where Adam Peters shines his expertise. So I'm glad you're having me on because this is what he did when he was here in San Francisco.
Yeah, so I think that's, you know, look, we all obviously had heard a lot about Adam Peters before the hire, you know, even a year ago, before Washington was, you know, doing anything, that Peters was the guy, like sort of almost like the next big thing to come out of the front office world of somebody who's not a retread, finally moves on from here. But obviously, I always find it fascinating. How do people who are not viewed, who are not the GM or not the main person, how do we know what they do and versus what other people do? Because obviously also Kyle Shanahan clearly has a voice in all of this. So as you were covering Peters and he was there, like how you mentioned that the draft was his world, but still, like, how did you kind of assess what power he had, what control he had? You mentioned, like, you know, some of the top picks they've had, some have worked, some haven't. How did you sense where Peters kind of ultimately though fit in with the whole situation there?
I thought that the best thing that Peters did was he really got an understanding of Kyle Shanahan and that coaching staff. And you could see that in the draft. They got better and better as time went on. So he got a greater understanding of what exactly Shanahan and that staff was after. Yeah, you're right. I mean, some picks had Shanahan's fingerprints all over them. And those were mainly wide receivers and running backs. But the defensive players, I know that John Lynch had a say on a lot of these. But to Lynch's credit, he really let Peters lead where Lynch was, you know, still learning. There wasn't an insecurity there on John Lynch's part. Lynch knew where, you know, he had some weaknesses as an evaluator, as a front office type, and he let his guys, and Martin Mayhew was part of that early on as well, take the lead on that. So my point is that Peters did have a lot of sway. And again, I don't think it was ever any tug of war. I mean, that, again, I think that was Peters' strength, is that he was eager to bring in guys that, would marry everything together. And that's for the most part what he did. Now, that 2017 draft, that started out with Solomon Thomas, a huge whiff, where they took him, number 3 overall, and also included Reuben Foster, who you guys are very familiar with there.
Mm-hmm.
So two big swings and misses early on. Now, there was also a really nice connection in the 5th round in them getting George Kittle. And that sort of salvaged that draft class. I think Kittle is now the longest tenured 49er. He and Kyle Juszczyk both came in 2017. But that just kind of shows you how long ago 2017 was. And like I said, each of the drafts, I think, got a little bit better from that point on.
So, I mean, Dan Quinn has said now multiple times that having now been around Adam for a little bit, that one of Adam's superpowers, as Dan Quinn says, is the ability to understand what I'd say, what I'm thinking we need, and then his ability to find that. Obviously, they just signed a half a roster's worth of free agents, and a lot of them were just guys who just to sort of help fill out the roster, but some specific ones, like Frankie Louvu, was probably their top signing. Dan Quinn, that gives Dan Quinn sort of that Micah Parsons chess piece to put all over the place. I don't think he had to do, I don't think he needed to add him too much to point to the former Cowboys center and defensive end who they brought in. I'm sure Quinn was like, yeah, just go get those guys. But that's what he calls it, the superpower. And that's what, you know, what I've heard, and kind of like what sounds like what you're saying as well, the understanding to what the team wants and how to go about it. I guess let me ask you, like, with let's just start with the quarterback. That's obviously been a fun one. And obviously, you know, the Trey Lance thing didn't work. The Brock Purdy thing has worked. We're trying to figure out which of these quarterbacks, namely Jaden Daniels, Drake May, or J.J. McCarthy, makes the most sense for what it is that Peters is looking for in some way, shape, or form. Again, it's hard to know where Kyle Shanahan wanted some pieces and if Peters is listening to the coaches. But I guess what's your sense, if there's any, of what a quarterback that Adam Peters might want himself, let alone, you know, how we factor in the other coaches?
I would say that the biggest thing or the biggest learning experience was from the Trey Lance episode, in that I wrote it down here. Trey Lance's college career amounted to 318 pass attempts. Part of that was due to COVID. Part of that was due to him coming out early. I think that that was a huge lesson that this team learned, that those college snaps are so important, and it's very hard to kind of make up that ground once you get into the NFL. And Lance's issue of inexperience was exacerbated by two early season injuries that he suffered. So he basically just fell behind and fell behind Brock Purdy, who did have a lot of college reps, college snaps. I haven't done one iota of work on the quarterbacks that you just mentioned,
Sure.
but that I imagine is a one of the factors that they're looking at. I mean, just how many reps have each of these guys gotten? How much work needs to be done when they get in? When can they, you expect this guy to start playing? With Trey Lance, they thought that they could give Lance a lot of reps early on to sort of make up the ground for his lack of college reps because he was such a good runner. The problem was that he was such a good runner at the North Dakota State level and wasn't such a good runner at the NFL level. So, that's another. I don't think the Commanders have to really worry about that. None of the guys that they're looking at played at a level North Dakota State was at. But I think that was something else. I mean, there were all sorts of issues with that year's draft. It was a COVID year. They never, got him in the building. They never really, you never took him to lunch, never took him to dinner. They never really saw this guy up close. And he turned out, didn't he wasn't quite as big and as imposing as he looked when he was going up against JMU and Illinois State. Again, those aren't things that they have to worry about in Washington, but I would say that those are hard lessons that Adam Peters took away from that year's draft.
I may have asked you this the last time you were on, but obviously there was a lot of confusion leading up to that draft. There was a lot of talk about they're going to take Mac Jones at three. Chris Sims was a guest on my podcast last week. There was this notion like that Chris Sims and Kyle Shanahan are friends, and Chris Sims is saying they're going to pick Mac Jones, which led to a lot of the, oh, I guess this is a thing, only for it to switch off at the end. Again, just in the context of trying to figure out Adam Peters, do you think that I guess A, was there really a switch? Or if there was that you think more about Adam Peters, however he was looking at the prospects, or Shanahan saying, hey, this is the guy I want?
I mean, we all thought it was Mac Jones too, because Adam Schefter was reporting that from way back. And Schefter and Mike Shanahan are quite tight, having written a book together. So the intel seemed to be all kind of pointing toward Mac Jones. No one knows what the story is. Shanahan and John Lynch, and probably Adam Peters, kept that very tight between among them that whole time. So very few people know the exact story. But one of the conjectures, I would call it, is that, Shanahan did like Mac Jones, and that the other two guys talked him out of it, or made hard arguments for the bigger upside players. And one of the bigger upside players was Trey Lance. Young guy, nice arm, great size, needs experience, but once you get that, he's going to be good. And that also explains why they cut ties with him so quickly. It's that Shanahan was never really on board with Trey Lance. And when it didn't work out initially, that just sort of accelerated that. So that might be something to look at. I mean, if you're picking that high, maybe the Adam Peters philosophy is You pick the guy with the biggest upside. Maybe not the guy who's going to be good right away, but the guy with a better arm, the guy with a better size, the guy who, in 5 years is really going to make some magic happen, but maybe struggles more in years one and two.
That's interesting because, obviously, whatever comparisons anybody wants to make with Brock Purdy, when you're picking a quarterback at the end of the seventh round, it's just at that point you're like with any other position to a degree, can we do something with this? This is not you're not thinking this is the guy that's going to take you to the Super Bowl. This is just, all right, we need something here. This is interesting. And a lot of people have been comparing, or at least some people have compared JJ McCarthy to Purdy from a skill set perspective, and therefore asking the question, could this be what Peters wants? I don't know if you heard, but when we were at the owners meeting, Tom Pelissero had a report on the NFL Network where he said, "Hey, I've been walking around here all week." And I say report. It's more of a passed along information. He said that he talked to various people who know Adam Peters, and based on them knowing him, they think the guy to look at is JJ McCarthy. Okay. So we all were like, all right, what does that mean? And then I get where the comparisons would be to Purdy, except that this is not a Kyle Shanahan offense. This is not, it's a completely different guy. So the only wonder was, like, to what degree does Peters and then Dan Quinn, who had Shanahan as his OC, sort of lean on those certain football principles from Kyle Shanahan, who's obviously had a lot of success. And if that's a way they would lean, I'm not asking you to guess because it's an unknown and you got your own stuff, but that's part of the idea here of what we're trying to think. So you saying you think Peters would maybe go for more of the upside is interesting, I think, to me in that regard.
The whole Trey Lance episode is still a mystery here. Nobody has really figured it out. Like I said, it was kind of kept in-house, so there wasn't any leaks. And I think that sort of that idea that Mike Shanahan knew what was going on is erroneous. I don't think he knew. I don't think anybody outside of that triangle really knew what was going on, including the assistant coaches. So, I don't know what I don't know what the lesson is there, but yeah, I would say that Peters was probably pressing for the bigger upside guy at that point.
You saying about how they're keeping that they kept things in house and nobody really knew is both it makes me feel a little bit better because that's how it's been here. There's been almost no information getting out. Both that's why we had all this coaching search confusion involving Ben Johnson, and I fear we're gonna have it as we get down the stretch and the whole quarterback situation intensifies. That we're going to get more of that too. So I guess this is the lesson that Adam Peters has taken away. Don't talk to anybody about anything. And I don't like that.
Yeah, although that also means that they're not blabbing throughout
Yes.
the year. And I remember covering Mike Nolan when he was the coach of the 49ers, and Nolan and Jay Glazer were tight. And Jay Glazer had a report every other day, a national report about the 49ers. And so I think it's better that the primaries in Washington aren't buddy buddy with members of the media.
Yeah, well, and I've been pointing this out that every time somebody like the Pelissero thing I just said, or when some of Schefter's things, they're almost none of them are saying sources say the Commanders are X. There's more of, as I look at things and I try to assess based on
Yeah.
that, I'll think this, which again, you're right. I kind of appreciate the fact that it's not going out to a select few and the rest of us have to chase. But at the same point, come on, Adam, what are you doing?
One thing that has been a pretty reliable guide, and this is probably true in every NFL city, but it certainly was here, is that usually the guys that the 49ers ended up drafting came on an official visit. There's very, very few exceptions of that. And I'm talking rounds one through seven. So, Ben, if you can figure out the 30 visitors to I forget what the name of the town is where
Ashburn.
Ashburn, then you would have a good idea who they're drafting. And I realize they're probably having visits with each of the quarterbacks, so that's not going to help you. But the later in the draft guys, the guys that come through, good chance that they end up on the roster.
All right. Well, that's good to know. That was a sign as well. You're right, under Rivera, especially I think last year in particular. But yes, it's as much information as we're getting from a lot of these situations, assuming we get the actual information and not just. I appreciate that some other people from outside the usual NFL world report on these things. I don't know how they seem to hear some of this, but at the same time, I'd like to hear it for myself before I assume that they interviewed so and so. But
I get
okay.
it.
Oh, okay. Okay, so there's that now. Let's go through some of the other quarterbacks really quick here. When you talk about the upside guys, I would think that Jaden Daniels may be of the of between him, May, and McCarthy, maybe is the top of that, considering one, the season he just came off of, the ability to make, big plays down the field, to run. He's not a scrambler per se, but when he runs, he's gone. When I've talked to people, it feels like there's more momentum or more of a separation between Daniels and the rest and the other guys. I know you said you haven't paid attention to these guys, and that's obviously pretty fair for what you're doing. But I'm just curious, like, does whereas like say Drake May's got the more prototypical size, 6'4", 220 something. He looks like people point to the Justin Herbert comparison, and that obviously rings true physically. There's a scouts seem to have more issues with him from like a. That may have regressed a bit with his decision making last year at North Carolina, his footwork, mechanics, things like that. Do either one of those guys sound more just generally like what you would think that for Peters would make more sense than the other one?
Well, I know that Trey Lance's size, his supposed sturdiness, was a factor for the 49ers, because, like I said, they thought that he was going to be able to run, kind of keep the offense going while he sort of learned the game. Turns out that all that sturdiness didn't amount to much because he got hurt quite a bit. Again, these are all sort of hard learned lessons for Adam Peters. The counter to that is that Brock Purdy is not a physical marvel by any stretch. He might just be 6'1" or a hair under, does not have a powerful arm. For Purdy, it's all of the kind of mental advantages. He sees things very quickly. And that's what allowed him to sort of hit the ground really running his rookie season. Once Jimmy Garoppolo got hurt, Purdy came into a game against Miami, and the offense didn't change one bit. And frankly, it got even better the more that he played. I wrote that story about the cognitive test. I don't know if you have access to what these guys scored and how quickly they process things, but processing speed, I would think that was another big lesson that Adam Peters learned, that processing speed can make up for a lot of physical the shortcomings on some of these quarterbacks.
Yeah, obviously, and when you're talking about the test that CJ Stroud supposedly didn't score highly on, and that led to a lot of questions and some
Yeah, the
controversy.
S2.
Yeah,
You know,
yeah.
he didn't embrace the test, put it that way.
Right, right.
The reason he scored so poorly isn't because he wasn't good at it, it's because he didn't try. And all of these teams knew that. His score was red flagged, and they basically said, yeah, he didn't really take it seriously. This is why the score is so low. So nobody really considered that low score when they were evaluating CJ Stroud.
Right. It was more of the public, the way it was presented to the public was, hey, this guy, there's maybe questions about what's going on, but internally, you're noting that everybody was like, no, we kind of know what's going on, but the framing publicly was not a deal, which I think led to, some agencies saying, hey, we're not going to have our guy do this because if the information's just going to get out there, what's the upside for us? So I don't know about these quarterbacks who, and I would almost think a lot of them would probably skip it because again, if you're not going to guarantee their protection, then, you know, what's the point? But obviously that is a notable factor for sure. I hate to say like this open-ended question, but for just in terms of the quarterbacks, anything else that for you comes to mind when you've thought about just what Adam Peters has talked about, looked at, what the 49ers did in general, that something we should keep an eye on?
Well, just to pick up on processing speed, I think processing speed probably goes hand in hand with experience, just the number of reps that you've taken as a quarterback. So I imagine that your processing speed goes up the longer that you played. So I don't know what the rep count is with Daniels versus May versus the Michigan quarterback, but you know, that might be interesting to look at how many pass attempts each of these guys has taken.
Fair enough. Let me ask you this. You know, we were talking before we started that, you know, what do we think they're looking to do from a scheme standpoint in a variety of ways with blocking, with whatever else. And, you know, between all these new pieces coming together, and again, the fact that, you know, we've only had limited time with these coaches, we haven't been able to chance to ask everything. So still learning to figure out, this is why the quarterback thing is so interesting. How much are they leaning into what a Cliff Kingsbury system is versus what Dan Quinn's personal desires want versus what Adam Peters learned in San Francisco. But from a roster building perspective, I'm curious, like beyond the obvious quarterback, are there positions that you think that he really leans into more than the others? The biggest position they spent on free agency essentially was linebacker, which is one that the team with Ron Rivera and Jack Del Rio, two former linebackers, kind of largely ignored during their 4 years. And I don't know how much getting Luvu and Bobby Wagner was about a want, you know, as Dan Quinn or Adam wanting that versus, you know, hey, we really want, this is where we really think we need to beef up our defense. And then similarly, as they're figuring out the offense, if there are a couple positions where you think that for Peters, it really is an emphasis, we've got to get this right.
Well, linebacker is interesting. I think that's probably the position that they've drafted the best here in San Francisco. They got Fred Warner in 2018 in the third round, and he was interesting because he wasn't a linebacker at BYU. He was basically a big nickel. He never lined up as a stack linebacker. He just spent a lot of time in coverage, and was able to cover a lot of ground. He had nice length. He's tall for a linebacker, and they've replicated that a couple of times. They like to draft. Peters likes to draft guys who play the star position in college, which is that quasi safety linebacker. Trying to think of a guy, Jalen Petrie at Baylor. He's now with the Texans, played it. So basically guys that have pretty good size, aren't traditional linebacker size, but they can move and they can cover. And so a lot of those guys have been turned into linebackers with the 49ers, and each of them has been successful in you know, different ways. But yeah, that's been, it's almost like they figured out the cheat code for drafting linebackers. You draft guys that can move and who spent a lot of time in coverage in college. Because that's what the game is now. Those guys are dropping back into zones. They're covering tight ends, et cetera, et cetera. So they've done a good job there. The other spot, and I know that Darrell Tapp is the defensive line coach there. And, you know, the big emphasis when he was assistant defensive line coach with the 49ers was get off speed. And we really started to look at guys 10-yard splits along the defensive line, and guys who really sort of in the 40 time didn't really matter as much as the 10-yard split did. So basically guys that just burst off the line of scrimmage. Now, I don't know if Dan Quinn is going to have that same really upfield defensive philosophy. The 49ers play a wide nine. It's all about kind of aggression and getting off the snap quickly, but that was something that Peters and his crew really started to look for in players. In fact, they created a stat. I don't know if you and I talked about this, but they call it GTFO. And it's something that their analytics department does, and it's stands for get the F off, which is just get off the line of scrimmage as fast as you freaking can. And so they were able to measure this for some guys, and they drafted them accordingly. And none of these guys were, top picks, but these were, I want to say, experimental picks, but guys, fifth, sixth, seventh round that, okay, this guy had a good speed here. He translates to what we do. Maybe it'll work out.
Interesting. Yes. Great acronym. Look forward to using that myself out there someday or talking about it. All right, let me ask you this, because again, it is a little confusing because there's so many chefs in the kitchen. I don't say that in a bad way, but we're still trying to figure out exactly, where are they going to emphasize what. But let me go back to the draft itself. If Adam Peters is the one who is essentially kind of choosing the players, when they made choices like let's make trade up for Trey Lance and, or just anything else, trade up, trade down, who's making that call? And based on anything that, what was your sense of the like? What's your sense of what Peters may look to do? They have, as a reminder, that for you, but for everybody else, they have 9 picks, 6 in the top 100. So beyond the number 2 pick, they've got a lot to work with. And I could easily see them trading up into the first round for a tackle. Could see them trading back to get more picks for next year, when I suspect they're really going to go for it. So what's your read on that aspect?
I think that Lynch did most of that here. I know that he did. The very first draft, they actually had the number 2 pick, and Chicago had the 3 pick, and they swapped places, and Chicago ended up taking Mitch Trubisky. And Lynch handled all that. Lynch's strength is that he's really well liked in the NFL. So he's good at those sorts of negotiations and things like that. I'm not saying that Peters isn't. I'm sure he was part of that, but it was Lynch literally doing the, getting on the phone and doing the trading and things like that. I think that Peters has a similar personality, and I think personality really goes a long way in being a GM. He's not as polished. Maybe he's not as extroverted as John Lynch is, but he's really well liked, well respected. I know that, you talk to a lot of agents. The agents that I talk to all seem to really, really like him. And that's not always the case, with these high level people in front offices. So I think that's got to be seen as a positive that, this is a guy who's honest, who's friendly, who's a straight shooter, and that usually kind of opens doors and maybe allows for more trades than maybe your run-of-the-mill GM.
I've been saying that all this time, going back to before he was even hired. And yes, you're asking anybody you can, hey, you've met him before, you've worked with him, whatever, tell me about him. I'm not looking for any dirt or negatives. Nobody's even come close to giving me any. It's all positive about it, almost to the point of being like, what's going on here? But you're right. I think that there's you can see why, seeing him in a worker room or a sideline or just even interacting with us, there's a there's a positive, friendly vibe there. He doesn't really even get into, like, at least to this point, he hasn't gotten into like any negatives, like talking about anything either. Obviously for him it's all new. It's not like anything's happened yet per se. So for him it's not a, there's no negatives to discuss. This is all moving forward and all positive. But it's everything, even just in general, even his basic comments, like I'm very self-deprecating. He seems very sunny. And I suspect that goes along with what you're talking about.
Keep in mind though, he was the assistant GM, so he was never the guy saying no.
Exactly.
He's sort of like the backup quarterback, where the favorite player on every team. So it's going to be a different position for him, but his disposition, he's a positive guy. he fit in really well with John Lynch. Yeah, I think that's gonna serve him very well as a GM moving forward.
And this is a lot great. Let me just ask you this in the last couple of seconds I have with you. One, Cleveland Farrell was one of the 8,000 free agents that they signed. Obviously, he was a rotation piece in San Francisco. It looks like he'll be that here. What are your impressions of him? And you know, what do you think Washington might be able to get out of him?
Don't expect any more than 3.5 sacks out of him. He's not a great edge rusher. He is a good teammate and player. I mean, he was Mr. Hustle on this team, and that was something that you and I discussed this when Chase Young took over for him. Chase Young was not known as Mr. Hustle, and so that contrast was very stark here. But people really liked him. He's a hard worker. You know, he's another guy that was totally overdrafted. A good cog piece, and he was basically their base down defensive end. So somebody who can hold the edge, who can play on those early downs, but probably should get him off the field on obvious passing downs.
Fair enough. Anthony Lynn.
Yeah, you know, it was sort of a odd fit here. Anthony Lynn was the running backs coach, also assistant head coach, but Bobby Turner is also the running backs coach here. And Bobby Turner was Anthony Lynn's mentor, coaching-wise. So they had two running backs coaches, and basically they ran the ship the way that Bobby Turner has. Bobby Turner is a longtime assistant of Mike Shanahan's and then of Kyle Shanahan's. So it's not like Anthony Lynn came in and did things differently. So bottom line, I never really got a very good read on Anthony Lynn and how he ran things. I do know a lot about Bobby Turner and what he likes. And I think Anthony Lynn is, you know, obviously cut from the same cloth. So one of the things that Bobby Turner does is he's old school. He will call 30, 40 running back prospects throughout this whole pre-draft period and just get to know each of them. And they've done a great job. This is dating back to the Denver days, you know. You'll recall all the running backs who had 1,000 yards for those Broncos teams, some of them obscure. Landis Gary, I can't remember the names right now, but that continued with the 49ers, where they're able to find late round, sometimes undrafted players and plug them in, and they do really well. And a lot of them are still in the league. Most of them are on the Miami Dolphins right now. I would think that Anthony Lynn is part of that, and you can look for the Commanders to draft running backs late and to bring in running backs after the draft to end up making a mark.
All right. Interesting. Last question. 49ers pick 31. Washington's first pick in the second round is 36. They're going to take a quarterback at 2, meaning offensive tackle's got to be addressed somewhere. I think that there's a lot of good tackles, but there's only like 7 or 8 of them, and then it thins out. And the question is going to be, how many of those guys are still there at 36? The answer may be none. And one of the teams I think could take a tackle, I think, is the 49ers. So if you're Washington, do you think they're going to have to jump the 49ers to get a tackle? Like, let's just say there's one, you know, one of these guys is left, Morgan from Arizona or Tyler Guyton or whatever. Do you think they're going to have to, San Francisco is in play enough to think that a team like Washington is going to have to jump them?
You might have to jump Baltimore too, because I think they're looking for a tackle.
Yeah.
You know, I try to find out who visits. I haven't figured out a single tackle who's visiting the 49ers. I mean, all of 49ers fandom thinks that they're taking a tackle. I'm starting to think they're not going to take a tackle, and that 49ers fandom is going to be very disappointed. So I don't know if that means that the 49ers think that the Tyler Guyton's are going to be gone by then, or they're just not that high in them. I don't know what it means. But I would think that if you wanted Tyler Guyton, you would have to get up back into the mid 20s or early 20s to get him. The Eagles are looking at Tyler Guyton. The Cowboys need a tackle, so that's going to be a tough one. The Arizona tackle, Jordan Morgan, he's probably more apt to be there, and he's a guy that people think that he could be in this kind of zone blocking scheme. He's good on his feet. He's not real physical. So that, I just don't know what kind of style the Commanders are going to be running.
Yeah, fair enough. Matt is awesome. You can tell he knows his team as well as anybody knows their team. Anything we need to know from you, being football fans, or I think at this point, anything that the 49ers do, even if it has nothing to do with Adam Peters, we're like, ooh, what? Oh, that's interesting. They think like that. So, what? Anything you got coming up? We should be taking a look at, or anything you already have up on the site?
No, well, I mean, they have their coaching staff get ransacked every year, so that's been a real challenge for Kyle Shanahan, is to kind of restock the cupboard every year. And they've got a this might be somewhat interesting to some of your listeners, but they've got a new defensive coordinator, Nick Sorensen, who grew up in Vienna, Virginia, Falls Church. Turns out that he grew up maybe, I don't know, 5 miles away from where I grew up. And we've been living parallel lives. He went to Marshall High School. I went to Madison High School. These were arch rivals, or at least they were when I was growing up. And then he went to Virginia Tech and I went to UVA. So we've been on opposite sides of everything, but he's their new defensive coordinator. And that's just something that the 49ers have had to do. Basically every year is basically reshuffle their assistant coaching staff. And here's something. I mean, I think that Darrell Tapp is really going to make a mark. I think you're going to see and hear him at practices. I think that defensive line group is going to be the loudest, rowdiest group at practice. You'll probably start to see that real soon when you start covering these practices. But I think that some of the holdovers on that defensive line are going to kind of enjoy the energy, and the new guys will as well. So that's something to kind of watch out for at Commanders practices.
It's always fun to have one or two coaches who, are loud slash aggressive with their language. That's always a treat for us too. Not, I mean, I'm sure the players don't always love it, but for us, like, oh, okay, something's interesting is happening beyond just, watching people hit a sled all the time. So that'll be fun. All right, I'll camp out by the D line.
Yeah, Darrell Tapp's another Virginia Tech guy. So make sure you speak very slowly, clearly to him. Those Tech guys aren't too sharp. So you can tell him I said
Deal.
that.
Matt, I really, really appreciate it. Good luck the rest of the way here in this draft cycle. And then you guys are back on the covering a team that's a contender, and we'll see if when Washington joins that club. Appreciate it, Matt, for the appreciate all the insight.
No problem. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. Big thanks to Matt Barrows and Al Galdi for their time. Thanks to everyone here for, as always, listening to the podcast, checking out all my work. Greatly appreciated. We are in a good spot right now. It's less than 2 weeks to go. The intensity is only going to ramp up. Hopefully, we all don't lose our minds in the interim, because no doubt the Daniels, May, McCarthy, etc. debates are going to continue. But that is it for now. Ben Standing signing off. Until next time, see ya.